My name is Jack Beecham. I live in the Wirral, which is in the northwest of England near Liverpool. I'm 71 years old and I've been retired about 12 years now. And my occupation was electrician all my life since I was 16 when I started off at Camelaids in Birkenhead. And since then, obviously, in living my life, I've always been a person who's respected the police force. When I was young and 9 years old, I used to play football in our road, and one policeman, a guy called Dougie, used to come along and park his bike up and play football with us. So we got an opinion of the police that they were very good and very helpful, and we respected them for what they did. And obviously, I was one of those people that, you know, never did anything wrong other than pinch apples when I was very young. But that was quite funny to think about that type of thing nowadays. However, moving on, 12 years ago, when I was just coming up to 60 years old, I was parked my car in a lay-by outside my dentist on the Wirral. The lay-by was at the side of a two-lane each-way road, main road, and at the end of the lay-by, there was a set of traffic lights, and as I got out of my car to shut the car door, the traffic lights turned to red. It's in Prenton, on the Wirral, which is a major road not far away from Tranmere Rovers football ground. It's outside a set of shops where the Sainsbury's, a large Sainsbury's superstore that's there, the other side of the traffic lights. So this happened at 5 o'clock on a Thursday night on May the 27th, 2010. And as I was getting out of my car to shut the car door, the traffic stopped alongside me inches away, about 12 or 14 inches away. And a silver Mondeo car was immediately alongside me. As I went to turn to shut my car door, a gust of wind blew, and before I could grab hold of the door, and blew my door to hit the plastic bumper of the Mondeo car. I looked at the Mondeo car and saw no damage whatsoever. So I grabbed the door and shut it and then locked it. And as I was walking round to the pavement, a man got out of this particular car, just an ordinary man in ordinary clothes with sunglasses on, and he started shouting at me quite aggressively. And he said, "Oi, you, stop there. You just criminally damaged my car." And I put my hands up and said, "Whoa, hang on, I haven't criminally done anything. I'm not that type of person." He said, "Well, you've got to stop there." He said, "I want your insurance details." And I said to him, I said, "Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, I'm prepared to give you my insurance details, but I've seen no damage." So I said, if you don't mind, I'm locked up and parked in a lay-by at the back of my dentist. There's an Aldi stroke home-based car park. I said, "I can walk down to the back of the shops and meet you there because you're on the main road and blocking the traffic." He said, no, "You've got to stop here." And he grabbed my arms, and I said to him, don't grab me. And he took his hands off immediately. He said, "I'm a policeman." Now, if you put yourself in my shoes, my car door has knocked against the silver Mondeo plastic bumper, and he's an ordinary person in ordinary clothes with sunglasses on. He didn't look anything like a policeman or even act like it with his aggression towards me. The only thing that would have made you think that he possibly could be a policeman was by using the words "criminally damaged my car." So I said to him, I said, "No, I said, I'd like to meet you at the back." As I was saying that, his mobile phone went off in his pocket. He grabbed his mobile phone and was talking on his mobile phone. And at this time, it was 5 o'clock at night, so there's a lot of cars at rush hour were starting to beep their horns because he's blocking the road, or the inside lane of the road. And I was getting quite embarrassed, so I gestured to him with my fingers I'd be walking down to the back of the shops and meet him there. Halfway down the alley to the back of the shops, a voice loudly shouted from behind me. And immediately, a hand grabbed my neck and spun me around. I'm 5'7", and at the time, 60 years old, or nearly 60 years old. He's four, well, I've discovered since, he's 6'2", and was 43 years old at the time. So there's a great difference in height and strength and everything there. So I pushed him off as he grabbed me by my neck, and we got to the end of the alleyway where the home bargain shops and Aldi shops were, and he's grabbing me and pushing me up against the fence, and he gets his hand and puts it around my throat, and he's choking me so that I couldn't breathe. Now, at this time, if you put yourself in other people's shoes and looking at it, it's just a tall man grabbing a little old man, pushing him up against the fence and choking him. Now, there were lots of shoppers inside the shops who could see what was going on, and they were banging on the windows to him. Because I couldn't breathe, I'm hitting the hand that's around my throat. And I happened to have my car keys in my hand, but I wasn't even thinking about that because I just wanted to breathe. And he then said to me, as I hit him with my hand, which had the keys in, "I'm now going to arrest you for assaulting a police officer in the execution of his duty." And I then managed to get his hand, and he's just got his elbow against my chest, still up against the fence. I'm not fighting or anything with him, but he's being that aggressive to me. So he goes on his mobile phone again, and he's ringing up. I couldn't make out exactly what he was saying. But whilst he was ringing up, a lady comes by who's a neighbour of mine who happens to work in the police as a typist. And she said to this man, neither of us knew at that point in time he was a policeman. She said, what are you doing to this man? He said, "I'm a policeman." And she said to him, "Well, I think you're unreasonable force against this man." He said, "No, I'm not." And carried on with his phone call. And literally within 8 minutes, 16 police cars with 32 policemen arrived at this car park, swarming the car park with all these policemen to grab hold of me, basically, which they put me in handcuffs and threw me in the back of a police car. At the same time, a CSI van arrived to take paint samples off my car, which is quite ridiculous, really. But at that point in time, I then believed he probably was a policeman. And we got to the police station, and he had me charged, or on a notice board as we walked into the police station, four counts against me on the notice board, which was criminally damaging his car, failing to stop after an accident, driving without insurance, and also...
Hang on, Jack, because you were stationary anyway. I mean,
that's right.
You're saying that you were trying to run away.
Well, failing to stop is with a car that you're driving, a car you've hit somebody and you're failing to stop is what failing to stop is. But if I can explain, Tony, the last count was assaulting the police officer in the execution of his duty. Now, we'd arrived at the police station at 6 o'clock, just before 6 o'clock that night. And by the time they let me out at 4 a.m. the next, 4:04 a.m. the next morning, the four counts that were on the board, two of them had been rubbed out, which was failing to stop and criminally damaging his car. So they'd interviewed me. And because I didn't have my insurance on me in the car, they put that was one of the two things, driving without insurance and assaulting the police officer, that was left. But the next day, when I got home and got my insurance, I went, took it to the police station, and they eventually dropped that one. So it only became one charge in the end of assaulting the police officer in the execution of his duty.
Okay, so who was this guy and what was his rank?
His name was Michael Cloherty, C-L-O-H-E-R-T-Y, Michael Cloherty, which if anybody wants to look it up on the internet, they'll see all the things that happened with him over the years anyway. However, he was a chief superintendent of Merseyside Police at the time, which was 2010 when this happened. And because, obviously, I was interviewed at 11:30 that night by a detective, not just an ordinary policeman, but by a detective, which is amazing for such a small thing of a car door blowing in the wind. However, this chief detective who interviewed me opened the conversation up with Mr. Beecham. He said, "I'm reading from the statements of Mr. Cloherty here, and he said that he cautioned and arrested you this afternoon at the scene." And I said, no, I don't remember him cautioning and arresting me. He didn't say, if you do this, I'm going to arrest you. He just said, I'm going to arrest you, is what he said. He didn't caution me. So I said, no, I don't remember that happening at all. He said, well, he says that in his statement. So I said, okay, that's your, what you're saying. And later on, when he finished the interview, which took about an hour, at the end of the interview, he said to me, what do you think, Mr. Beecham, of the events of today? And I said to him, I said, well, to begin with, I didn't believe he was a police officer. He didn't identify himself to me. He said, well, he said he did. He did. I said, well, he did. We don't believe that he did. And there were two young girls who came forward as witnesses who watched the whole thing. And even in their statements of these two young girls, they said he never showed Mr. Beecham any cards or identity at all. However, that's what the detective told me. So he said, well, what do you actually think? I said, well, because I didn't believe he was a policeman at first, and then I did believe it when I saw 16 police cars turn up and all these policemen. I sort of thought it was just an over-the-top situation which has got out of hand. I said, I actually think, I said, that because I now do believe that he's a policeman, and you're saying he's a chief superintendent of police, I believe that because I didn't obey him, like he expects everybody to jump and they say our highs, sort of thing, he didn't like my resistance to him. I said, so basically, after that time, we went to the magistrate court about 7 or 8 months later in the end. And when he turns up in the magistrate court with his full uniform with the pips on his shoulders, looking very smart, my solicitor with me said, you may lose this today, Jack. And I said, well, we'll see. Now, obviously, whilst the judge was questioning Mr. Clowarty in the magistrate court, they were building up a rapport between them, which was quite embarrassing, I thought, the way they were praising each other there. And I thought, well, the way this judge is acting is very poor, really. However, they were saying how they had the same mobile phones and things like this together, sort of thing, but it was quite, horrible to watch in some senses. But in the end, the judge turned around and said, Mr. Beecham, he said, I do believe you are a good man, but I believe on that particular day that you lost it, and you swore at Mr. Clowarty. Now, I don't swear, even so the way I talk, I just don't swear, sort of thing. My son who was in, or one of my sons who was in the court at the time, stood up and he shouted at the judge, my dad doesn't swear, my dad. And the judge told him off quite badly, really. But he was standing up for something that he believed. So, but in the end, he found me, I think it was £300 court costs and £400 compensation to Mr. Clowarty. So I got a £700 fine in the magistrate court. When we came out of the court, I said to my solicitor, I'm not happy with this. I would like to appeal it. And he said, Jack, don't appeal it. You can't take on the police. I said, well, hang on. I want to appeal it, but the reason is that I did not do anything. I defended myself. I didn't go out to attack a person. I defended myself. I said, he was choking me. There was a red mark on the nurse in the custody suite. Took notes of the marks on my neck from him when he was grabbing me around the throat. I said to I want to appeal it to the Crown Court now. And he said, Jack, he said, if you appeal to the Crown Court and you lose, which you've got a good chance of losing, it won't be £700, it'd be over £2,000. So I said, well, do you want to, represent me? He said, in the court. He said, well, I don't think you'll win. I said, well, okay, I'll break our ties with each other, sort of thing, which we did. I then went to two or three other solicitor firms in Liverpool, giving them my story, and two other solicitor firms in Liverpool were reluctant to take it on with me, which I thought, well, obviously it's not good going to the police force of the area, the solicitors of the area where the police force is. So in the end, I decided to go to Manchester, which is great rivalry with Liverpool, and I found a solicitor in Deansgate in Manchester who took the case on for me, a company called BPS Law, very big firm, very well represented. BPS Law believed in my story. We then sat down, a team of three of us, sort of thing. A friend of mine is very brilliantly minded legally, and myself, and this main solicitor, one of the partners of BPS. And for 18 months, we put in disclosure requests to the police. This is the big thing that people in the country don't really know how, when they take on the police, or most people don't want to take on the police because they're reticent with regards to what they need to know and everything like this. However, with what we did, we were able to ask the police. But there's a thing called undisclosed materials that the police don't give people before they get to court. Now, if people knew what they were doing and asked for the undisclosed materials that the police haven't given to you, you'll discover an awful lot of things that you didn't realise. And within the undisclosed materials, we got the pocket notebook of this Mr. Clowerty, and we read his pocket notebook of what he said on the day. And the pocket notebook was very, very suspicious. It started on page one. So when we had three or four, we had the appeal set for July 2012, just over a year later. So in that 11 or 12 months before the appeal hearing, Judge H.H.J. Holloway from Shrewsbury came out of retirement because he could see there was myself taking on a high-ranking police officer. He'd been on the bench for 40 years, and he decided to come out of retirement to do this case in Liverpool, which is very interesting, really. And in the three hearings that we had prior to the hearing for the appeal itself, there were disclosure hearings with the court, basically. We went and we'd written down 54 items of disclosure that we wanted from the police with the three of us that we'd put together, which the prosecution barrister was up in arms in the court when we asked for these 54 items, saying to the judge, it's just too much, he can't do it. But fortunately, with Peter, one of my friends who's the legal brain of our team, with every item that we asked the judge with the order from the prosecution, had a reason with it. So when the judge looked at the reason for every item, my barrister, which is a lady called Suzanne Goddard, she's now a circuit judge in Preston. She was representing me because obviously when you get to that particular stage of an appeal in a Crown Court, you need a QC. So she became our QC because BPS knew her quite well. And it turns out that obviously she looked at my 54 items that we'd given to her to ask the judge for, and she said, Jack, that is a lot of things I don't think is reasonable, and I don't think you're going to get it. And Peter said to me, he said, Jack, whatever Suzanne thinks, that's her thoughts. What, you're the actual person going to court, and you have the right to instruct your legal people to ask for the things that you want. And we put this together and keep it, you know, asked Suzanne, would she do it? So I met with Suzanne, said, Suzanne, can I instruct you please to ask for those 54 items despite what you think? And she said, okay, Jack. So when we got to the court hearing, the judge looked at every item and he was ticking it as he went along. And in the end, the judge ordered every one of the 54 items. And Suzanne came out of the court smiling, thinking she'd made it all happen when we'd done it behind the scenes in some senses, you know. But the big thing was we'd got the judge to agree because of the reasoning of it. One of the items that we asked the judge to order from the police was the previous pocket notebook for Mr. Clowerty, because we were suspicious with this pocket notebook that he used on the day, starting on page one. So we asked for that, and the judge ordered it from the police. When the hearing itself arrived in the July 2012, Mr. Clowerty had to come to court with various items that we'd asked for: his sunglasses, his coat that he wore, and different other things, which were important but not drastically important. The biggest thing, or one of the biggest things, was his pocket notebook, basically. And it turns out when he arrived in court and the judge asked him for his pocket notebook, he said, Your Honour, in 23 years as a policeman on Merseyside Police, he said, I've never lost a pocket notebook. And in the last 3 weeks, I've looked everywhere to try and find his pocket notebook, and I can't find it. And the judge threw his pen on the on his desk and said, "This is, I've ordered this from myself. You need to have an investigation into it and everything like this." However, we wanted it for the reason being that we wanted to see what date it ended on, because and how it followed through to page one on this next. Because how unusual, he's got a pocket notebook that's starting on page one. And it turns out that the front page or the front cover of the pocket notebook had a commencement date of the 19th of May 2010, which was 8 days prior to the incident on the in the road in Prenton, in Birkenhead, Woodchurch Road it was called. So we then looked and at it all, and in, we didn't think too much about it because Aston News 8 days before, but it still was suspicious. So in the end, the police, different policemen came along to give evidence out of the 32 policemen, not all of them, but different ones. And it turns out a Sergeant Pottle from Merseyside Police was an honest policeman. In my opinion, the Merseyside Police have 40% honest policemen and 60% dishonest policemen, in my experience, despite me thinking up to over 60 years old now, that the police force were very honest and, you know, very good, and I turned out I was very naive in some senses. However, this Sergeant Pottle had been in a sergeant in the army up till 6 months before. And because he was a sergeant in the army and he joined Merseyside Police, he became immediately a sergeant within Merseyside Police. Fortunately for ourselves, he hadn't been indoctrinated into the team of policemen within Merseyside teams, is what we're purporting it to be, because he was totally honest. And when it came to the him giving evidence in the Crown Court in Liverpool, they played the tape of the audio tape over the loudspeakers in the court, and he was asked a few questions, Sergeant Pottle, and then he put his hand up, and the judge said, "What do you want, Mr. Pottle?" And he said, "Your Honour," he said, "you're playing only part of the conversations that went on." And he said, "What do you mean?" He said, "This production here is from Wave Band 2. And the judge said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, there's four wave bands on Merseyside Police that we use. Two go one way and two go the other way." He said, "You haven't got Wave Band 4, which is a response from the police, which you should have so that I can give you the full answers to everything." Well, at that point in time, because of so much many other things and the pocket notebook being lost, the judge stopped the case. And he said, "It's absolutely impossible that Mr. Beecham can have a fair hearing here because of the police's failure in producing the evidence that they've asked for." So he decided there and then, after 3 days of the hearing, which should have been a 5-day hearing, to stop the case. And he found in my favour and completely overturned the magistrate's decision of 18 months prior. And in doing that, he then awarded BPS Law their full costs for, you know, their work in the time, which included the barrister and everything, but nothing for me. However, their cost was, to the public purse, £146,000 for this car door blowing in the wind has caused that at that point in time.
Well, that's amazing, isn't it? And I know, unbelievable. Jack, also, since then, you've actually discovered quite a lot about this particular officer, haven't you?
Well, what happened, just to finish it off, Tony, on this last point, because this is what made that happen, you see. When the judge found in my favour, he then summarised the case in the court, and he said, "Mr. Beecham, many Merseyside police officers have manipulated evidence to get you punished." Now, that was very massive for me because of my trust in the police up to then. That if many police officers had acted on behalf of Mr. Clougherty, as because he was a top man, and they'd manipulated other evidence to get me punished, that was the straw that broke the camel's back in my mind then, because even though I'd won the case at that point in time, I hadn't been awarded anything for me at that moment in time, just BPS Law got all of the money. So coming away from the course, I decided that all we could do with Peter, which was very good, he said, Jack, we need to now make, because of what the judges said, freedom of information request to Merseyside Police and subject access request to the data department, which is what we did do. So from the July 2012, in very early, I think it was February 2013, we asked, one of the questions that we asked to the Freedom of Information was, can you please produce evidence to us of what date the pocket notebook 257612, it was a number of it, was issued out to Mr. Clowarty. So that was an amazing piece of information that we asked for, because when the result came back that it was not issued out until the day of the incident, the 27th of May, not the 19th of May, then we discovered that he'd backdated his pocket notebook by 8 days to get it to look contemporaneous to the judge. So he'd falsified a pocket notebook, and in the pocket notebook he'd made 6 pages about the incident at the time, which was to correct failures that he'd made in his MG 11 statements. On the night, Mr. Clowarty at 6 o'clock went into the office in the police station and typed out for an hour and a half 3 pages of his statement, which is called an MG 11 statement. Now, in that MG 11 statement, there was a lot of false things. It's come to light since that he'd made up about me, and also it was an unlawful statement, so he could not charge me for what he charged me for based on that statement alone. Now, we believe, because he was chief superintendent and was so far away from being a constable on the road and knowing all of the up-to-date laws, that he didn't know what he was doing with the laws. And when you look at the, which is why I mentioned it, DC Walton, who interviewed me, Detective Constable Walton, that night, and he'd opened his statement up by saying, Mr. Clowarty cautioned and arrested you. That's a major thing that needs to happen. It's what's known as PACE guidance, and the police can only charge anybody if they've adhered to the PACE guidance rules. Now, the PACE guidance rules were that he had to caution and arrest me. Now, the opening gambit of Mr. Walton was, Mr. Clowarty says in his statement, his MD11 statement here, that he cautioned and arrested you today. And I said, no. Now, when we asked in our items of disclosure for the MG11 statement, which came eventually, the MG11 statement did not have anything in it at all that DC Walton said in the interview, which I've got the tape of the interview. So he was making something up to cover up the PACE guidance failure that his boss had made.
Just to be clear, PACE is the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, and this is the law that governs the way that the police have to behave during the point of assessing whether someone's committed a crime and arresting them and processing them, for example, in the custody suite at the police station.
That's right. If Mr. Clowarty had put in his MG11 statement that he cautioned and arrested me, his statement would have been lawful and he could have arrested me. Now, because we didn't know at the time, we found this out since because of Judge Holloway telling us about all of the policemen manipulating evidence, Mr. Walton, Detective Walton, had obviously, he was more up to date with the laws of the land and PACE guidance and everything, and he could probably see in the MG11 statement that he had in his hand that this wouldn't be good enough to arrest me. So it didn't meet the PACE rules, you say. And this is quite a crux to the whole thing, really, because if you think about it, and this is why we think the pocket notebook was lost, on that day, on that morning that he went into work at 7 a.m, Mr. Clowarty, he only had in his possession pocket notebook 240161, which was his old lost pocket notebook. Now, we believe, because he didn't know what he was doing, that he took his pocket notebook, his old pocket notebook, and filled in the unlawful MG11 statements. Now, then he's then got a piece of evidence, which is his MG11 statements, and then his pocket notebook, that neither of them met the law. So therefore, he couldn't get me charged and carry it through. So because he was in over 700 Merseyside police officers on the whittle, which he was, he'd all got to know because of 16 police cars and 32 policemen turning up that Mr. Clougherty was assaulted last night. By everybody was getting to know because they were all talking between each other. So consequently, he was in a difficult position that night. We believe that Mr. Walton found at 11 p.m. that night realised that Mr. Clougherty had made a big mess of his MG11 statement, and then he'd probably told him, and he probably said, "Oh, I've done the same in my pocket notebook." You see, now what we found out since from the police, further freedom of information from the police, that the pocket notebook issuing officer, which is a lady called Claire Louise Graham, who's still with Merseyside Police, she issues pocket notebooks out to all police officers on the Whittle. Now, she will not, because she's following a guide, give a pocket notebook out to anybody unless they sign it from her and they prove to her that their old pocket notebook is complete. Now, that's her duty. Now, she's made a statement that went to court to say, "I do not remember Mr. Clougherty coming to my office on the 27th of May. And I can say that I did not sign the pocket notebook issue log sheet for this pocket notebook. Mr. Clougherty did." Now, he's the top man in the office where she works. So she's just a young girl giving pocket notebooks out. If the top man comes in and says, "Claire, give me a new pocket notebook. Oh, we've got to do this. Give me the piece of paper." So in his interview, Mr. Clougherty was charged by the CPS in 2016. In his criminal interview, Mr. Clougherty said to the police who interviewed him, "I signed for the pocket notebook 2 days after the event, but I backdated the date to the 27th. Now, that is a massive problem that they've got at this point in time, because he said in that particular Preston Crown Court in 2016, "I had pocket notebook 257612 in my possession on the day." Now, obviously, he couldn't prove that because he'd lost his old pocket notebook. And Claire Graham says she should be signing the log sheet, but she didn't. And he said he signed for it 2 days later. And she says, "I never give one out without it being signed for."
Well, it sounds to me like old Chief Inspector Clougherty is dicing here with potential serious criminal charges, perverting the course of justice, perjury, this kind of thing. So can you just explain what you found out through the Freedom of Information requests, Jack?
Yes, well, the Freedom of Information then, on the log sheet, it said pocket notebook 2427612 was issued out on the 27th of May. And that right away then gave us, proof that we didn't believe that it was in use, basically. And with him backdating it by 8 days, which is a Hillsborough-type scenario. Why backdate it by 8 days on the front of it? Because the judge would, if it went into court with the actual date on it, the judge would be interrogating him, we believe. So consequently, what we believe then is within weeks, literally weeks of this Freedom of Information result coming to us, Mr. Clougherty would have known of what was going through to me. He left Merseyside Police, as a chief superintendent at 47 years old. He said he retired, but, it's too young for retirement. You can't retire till you're 50. I don't know. Even so, he's still left at 47 years old, because since then, he's been found with internal investigations with Merseyside Police to have been a dishonest police officer. However, if he would have stayed, and he now know he's a dishonest police officer, he would have lost his pension, which is why he obviously got out when he could, within those weeks of that information being given to us. And consequently, we presented in 2014 all of the evidence that we'd gathered through our requests for Freedom of Information and SARs, with proof of three other MG11 statements that Mr. Clougherty made that were all false against me. So consequently, when we found out all of these things, we presented it to Merseyside Police, who then had a detective Sergeant Kingsbury, Kevin Kingsbury, who got in touch with BPS Law in Manchester and said to them, he's taking up the complaints of BPS Law on my behalf at Putney Merseyside Police, which was three criminal actions. One was perjury, another was preventing the course of justice, and the last one was misconduct in the public office. So we presented that to Merseyside Police with the evidence. 16 months Mr. Kingsbury took to investigate the charges, because obviously the CPS were now involved and they'd taken his offer, so it wasn't an ordinary local resolution investigation, it was a criminal investigation that the CPS were overseeing. So consequently, during that 16 months, Mr. Kingsbury had been in touch with BPS Law on a few occasions saying, we've got him, Mr. Kwasnik, my solicitor, we've got him. He said, we can prove that the timeline of the 27th of May, when he went to work at 7 o'clock in the morning, we actually got disclosure on all of the telephone calls he made that day from the police. All of his action, he was at 2 p.m. that day, he was supposed to have been, which his pocket notebook says, he was at Neston Pop Festival site, which is a pop festival happening on the Friday to the Sunday the next day, and he was there leading 12 other high-ranked officers on what their duties were during the pop festival that was to start the next day. So he was meeting at 2 p.m. at the pop site, you say. Now, after 2 p.m., a PC Landrum had come from Bromborough Police Station, which is about 12 miles away, and had travelled from there to the police station to pick up 10 pocket notebooks for police officers in his station. So he's put down in his pocket notebook, left from a police station at 2:15 to pick up pocket notebooks from Wallasey, arrived back at 3:15, an hour, 20 minutes there, 20 minutes getting the pocket notebooks and 20 minutes back to the station. So then there was a PC Andrews picks up pocket notebook 257611, which is the immediate preceding pocket notebook to Clohertie's, which was 612. He picks up after this PC Landon picked up 10 pocket notebooks. He'd picked up one pocket notebook. The very next pocket notebook on the log is Mr. Clohertie's. So therefore, if Mr. Landon had gone, got back, or gone at 2:15, say, to pick up the pocket notebooks, he wasn't there. And if PC Andrews had picked up a pocket notebook after him, then what Mr. Kingsbury said, that he could not possibly have picked up a pocket notebook before 2:40 that particular day. And yes, he was at a pop site at 2 p.m., you see. Now, we had his mobile phone records. We got every possible bit. Disclosure is a massive, massive thing. Anybody listening to this, if you've got any problems with the police, they need to develop the disclosure, undisclosed materials and things like this, and dig and dig and dig like I've done. It turns out he uses his own mobile, police mobile, when he's out driving. He's got a cradle, a Bluetooth cradle in his car, so he can use it while he's driving. But we got his mobile phone records because from 7 a.m. until it looks like 1:15 p.m., he was at his desk in the office in Wallasey, so he'd never used his phone. I think he might have used it once at 10:30 that particular morning. But between 1:23 and 1:55, which is 5 minutes before the meeting at 2 p.m., he'd made 6 phone calls on his mobile phone. So if he was still at his desk up till 2:40 to get a pocket notebook himself, then he wouldn't have needed to use his mobile phone, you see. So Mr. Kingsbury failed to get hold of the 12 police officers at the pop site to get their pocket notebooks to prove that the meeting happened. However, Mr. Clohertie's in his pocket notebook says 2 p.m. next pop festival meeting with 12 officers. So you take that as being a genuine item put in the pocket notebook. So therefore, up to that time, up to 1:20 p.m., he hadn't taken pocket notebook 257612 out. And if he would have done, taken one at that point, it would have been a lot of numbers before that. because two other people since he left has got pocket notebooks. The next pocket notebook after Mr. Clougherty's pocket notebook was taken out was on the 4th of June, a week later. So therefore, if you put the whole of that evidence together, Mr. Clougherty met me at 5 p.m. after he'd been at the pop site all afternoon. So he'd not been back to Wallasey Police Station. At 4:43 p.m., Claire Louise Graham locked a door and left for the day. So pocket notebook 257612 was still sitting in her desk in her office. Mr. Clougherty then got back after the custody suite and is typing up the MG11 in Birkenhead, got back to his own station at Wallasey at 7:30 p.m. And then he made five more telephone calls on his mobile phone between that and 7:45. Between that and 7:55. The last phone call that he made was to his wife at home to say, because he left at 8 o'clock according to his notebook records, you see. So therefore, he'd left to go home at 8 p.m. So therefore, between 8 p.m. and 1:23 p.m., the pocket notebook 257612 was not issued out. Now, we believe that he said he'd filled his pocket notebook out before he left Wallasey Police Station at 8 p.m. That's what he told the judge in the court. So therefore, the only pocket notebook that he could have put information in was 240161. If he's put in the same information that he put in on his MG11 statement, both items would be unlawful items that he couldn't charge me with. He would have had to drop the case against me. And therefore, he would have been quite embarrassed with 700 people thinking he's charged somebody because he's been assaulted. And then all of his men find out that he'd made out an MG11 statement that was unlawful with the PACE guidance. So therefore, we believe DC Bolton had been in touch with him maybe the next day on the 28th and said, "Sir, you've got two options here. You must drop the charges against Mr. Beecham because all of your paperwork's not right. It's a mess. Or, you know, the only other thing you could possibly do is take out a new pocket notebook to rectify the problems of the MG11 statements." Now, in the Crown Court, Mr. Clougherty agreed with the barrister in 2016 that the new pocket notebook, did rectify the PACE problems. So when you put all of the things together, what's the most likely probability in all of that, basically? So consequently, it looks, you know, that he's messed about. In 2017, after this Crown Court case, which I'll go into this Crown Court actions in a minute, our civil claim in 2014 could not get investigated by Merseyside Police against Mr. Clougherty until his criminal CPS case in 2016 had been completed. So, but in 2017, when he was investigated by a DS Spike in Merseyside Police, DS Spike found on seven of our counts of complaints against Mr. Clougherty and the pocket notebook that on six of those counts, they'd upheld in my favour, Merseyside Police, to say Mr. Clougherty had taken out a pocket notebook, breaching the policy of the pocket notebook system. And he was dishonest in six of those counts. The other one, they couldn't make a decision either way, so it became a no, not upheld, basically. However, he couldn't do that until the Crown Court CPS proceedings of the three indictments were heard in the Crown Court in Preston. Now, those three counts of perjury, perverting the course of justice, and misconduct in police public office were heard in the Preston Crown Court, which was a six-day trial, which they brought up a judge, a High Court judge now, from London to Preston for the 6 days of the hearing, which is a Mr. Justice Goss, his name. I went for the whole of the time with Peter, my friend, and with my elder son, Ian, to the trial in Preston, which is about 60, 70 miles away from where I live. And on the second day of the trial, a gentleman walked in. We're in the public gallery. A gentleman walked in about 10:15 a.m. and he sat in the row of seats behind us. And when it came to 10:30 and the judge had ordered a break, this man tapped me on the shoulder and said, are you Mr. Beecham? I said, yes. He said, I'm a retired policeman. I'd like to have a word with you if it's possible in the side room during the break, which we did do. And this officer, which was a Mr. Sadruddin Hussein, he said, I've come 84 miles to this trial today to see you. He said, I should have been given testimony this week for the prosecution, but Merseyside Police, 2 weeks before the trial, had told me that I wasn't wanted anymore. He said, and I'm going to tell you now that I worked underneath Mr. Clougherty, and on many occasions, myself and five or six other officers were instructed by Mr. Clougherty to falsify our pocket notebooks to get members of the six or seven members of the public charged with things that he hadn't done. He said, and I was the only one who stood up to him and told him I wasn't going to do it. And he said, I was ostracized by him and the group of people. He said, and in the end, I had to put in a report to the Chief Constable, Betterson, then. And he said, Mr. Betterson brought me in to the Merseyside Police. And in the end, he said, they paid me off to leave the force. And I had to sign an agreement for so many years not to say anything about it.
Well, that's called a non-disclosure agreement. These are notorious ways of just basically muzzling people and actually stopping them talking about facts which are criminal evidence against people in that profession. Actually, they are similar things go on in places like the BBC. When people are dismissed from the BBC, they get them to sign these non-disclosure agreements.
Right.
I mean, what you're describing, it sounds like a clique. It's almost like a police within the police.
That's right. That's right. Basically, when Mr. Hussein told me of the incident, he said, Mr. Beecham, he said, when I saw the front page of the Liverpool Echo news of a corrupt cop going to court and realised it was Mr. Clougherty, I knew that I couldn't keep quiet any longer. He said, so I got in touch with Merseyside Police in 2016 and gave them a witness statement stating what my experience with Mr. Clougherty in falsifying pocket notebooks. He said, because I knew one day it would bite him back. He said, and now, obviously, I was supposed to be given evidence this week, and because they've dropped me, he said, it's amazing. I don't know why they dropped me, because obviously I'm a major witness, because it goes to the heart of the issue of the crimes that he was charged with. On the first day of the Crown Court, Judge Goss said to the whole court, Mr. Clougherty, you've been charged with three indictments. And then he said to the jury, he said, members of the jury, you must consider all the evidence against Mr. Clougherty on all three counts. If any one of the three counts you cannot find him guilty, then all of the other two counts are dropped, basically. He said, so even though you may find him guilty on the other two, all three are dropped. And I don't understand that from a justice point of view, because even if you don't find him guilty on one, but you do on the other two, he should be found guilty on those two alone. I really don't understand it. I was having a word with a barrister today, and he said, that's the justice system that we've got here in England, Jack, he said. However, there was another piece of evidence that arrived in the court that week, which we'd not known about, which was only discovered 2 weeks before the trial, which that's consistent with Mr. Hussein getting dropped 2 weeks before the trial. And it was produced by Merseyside Police that his computer on his desk was still in use up to 2:04 that particular day. Doesn't say he was using it. I mean, I've left my computer and it turned itself off after a period of time. And they've never confirmed that he was on his desk using it. But it was what's known as a seed of doubt put into the jury's mind, which he had a barrister called Chris Dorr, who was an excellent barrister, although it was against me. He was an excellent barrister, the way he manipulated the evidence to get Mr. Clougherty off. Because the seed of doubt, the jury cannot find him guilty. So the seed of doubt was that his computer was still on, so he could have been in the police station at 2:04, and he could have gone and got his pocket notebook off Claire Louise Graham just after then. But obviously, Mr. Kingsbury hadn't nailed all of the evidence down thoroughly to prove that he couldn't have got it before 20-3.
Yeah, Jack, can I just ask you to talk a bit about the how you got to know that the other, actually very serious problems that this police officer had earlier in his career?
That's right. Mr. Hussein said to me, he said, Mr. Beecham, he said, I can tell you something else about Mr. Clarity. He said, whilst I was with him, he was known for his road raids. When we were out in the roads, in the cars, which I have been many times with him, he's aggressive, and he said he met a group of people one particular night, and he was just very nasty and hollow, and drove at them one particular day, and so they'd run away. He said one day in Shaw Street in Liverpool, there was four girls crossing the road in Shaw Street, which is a 30 miles an hour road, and this police, unmarked police car, was zooming down way above the 30 mile an hour speed limit, and it hit, Mr. Hussein told me this, he said, it hit one of the girls, a young girl called Kelly Edgar, her name. I know her sister Leanne now, that's why I said Leanne, so sorry about that. So Kelly Edgar was 11 years old, and she got hit by Mr. Clarity's unmarked police car. Her head hit the windscreen, smashing his windscreen, and he carried her on his bonnet for about 27 metres before she was thrown off into the street, and he came to a halt 57 metres away. Now, the RAC guidance for a car driving at 30 miles an hour, it would stop within 20 metres. Stopping 57 metres away, he must have been driving, according to the RAC, at over 55 miles an hour at the point in time.
What happened to this young woman?
She died. She died two or three days later in hospital in Liverpool. And that's where Mr. Hussein comes in, because that was a Saturday night, and on the Monday morning, with his sergeants and two other police officers who was in the same team as Mr. Clarity, they were all asked to go with the sergeant to Mr. Clarity's house in Formby, where he lives, to visit him. He still lives there today. And he said, Jack, he said, I sat on the couch in Mr. Clarity's front room there with our sergeant doing the talking only. And he said to him, Mike, don't worry. This, you won't be affected by all of this. We will make sure. And he said, I've been wrestling with that for many years. He said, I can't, when I know that young girl has died. It turns out he wasn't going to any scene, which is why he was driving over the limits. He was, with his road rage, he was racing another policeman who was on St. Anne Street back to the police garage to get their own cars to go home at 8 o'clock that Saturday night. And obviously, because he's hit this one girl, that was, that's what happened, basically. And then, apparently, what I'm told by the family, because I met the family last year, Kelly's father, a year later at the graveside, tried to hang himself. And unfortunately, one of the family got there and found and got him, sort of thing, before it happened. Her mother died a few years ago, heartbroken that the police had got away with this all, because it turns out Mr. Clarity was charged with careless driving at that point in time. And when it came to, this is what the family have told me in the past 12 months, when it came to the day of the decision by the Liverpool Magistrate Court of all things, a young girl's died. It turns out that the last day of the hearing, it was a closed court. The public couldn't come in. And on the last day of the hearing, one of the family members has said that it was discovered that the police had lost the paperwork of the driving incident and the miles an hour and all the other things against Mr. Clarity. So in that case, the judge dropped the case against him. And that was absolute madness. And he's gone on from there, and according to Mr. Hussein and other police officers who have found out since, other retired police officers, Mr. Clarity didn't care about anybody in the police force. He just stepped over them to get to where he was trying to get to. And Andrew Cook, who was the next in line manager above him, when all this happened, Mr. Cook was the assistant chief constable. He since became the chief constable in 2016. And this is very interesting for everybody to listen to, because if Mr. Hussein was paid off by one police chief constable, and now Mr. Cook was the next in line manager, that Mr. Clougherty had to, when a policeman loses a pocket notebook, they had to report it to their immediate manager, which then was Mr. Andrew Cook. Now, Mr. Andrew Cook joined Merseyside Police in 1986 and Mr. Clougherty in 1987. So by the time 2012 comes along, obviously Mr. Clougherty is now a high-ranked chief superintendent, and Mr. Cook is one rung above him as the assistant chief constable. And because he then became the chief constable, you could see where Mr. Clougherty was going to end up if he hadn't had to leave Merseyside Police because of my freedom of information disclosure. However, when Mr. Cook, when he said, Mr. Clougherty, that he'd reported the lost pocket notebook to the judge in the Crown Court, to Mr. Cook, we put in freedom of information request to Mr. Cook about what he should have done in his position with a lost pocket notebook, because if a Crown Court had ordered such an important piece of evidence that was lost, then something needed to be procedurally done by Mr. Cook. Well, Mr. Cook didn't do anything. And when Mr. Cook was investigated by my request to the Police and Crime Commissioner, Jane Kennedy, in 2017, Mr. Cook was investigated. He said to the Chief Detective of North Wales Police, because another police force, if the Chief Constable, in 2017, he was the Chief Constable, Mr. Cook, you say. So in 2017, when he was investigated by North Wales Police, he was asked about the pocket notebook, and his response to North Wales Police was, "It was so long ago, I can't remember. I've lost my memory of it," which is a famous tactic or card that the police play in many court hearings, which I've been to get used to sitting in the Crown Court before I went to my Crown Court hearings, if you see what I'm saying. So I have heard that particular phrase many times from the police. However, because Mr. Hussein has been helpful in many things and telling us what different things have been happening within the police, apparently when I put in a freedom of information request to Merseyside Police last year, or just over 12 months ago, 15 months ago, I put in the request that, based on Mr. Hussein being paid off by a previous chief constable, I just put in a normal freedom of information request saying, "Dear freedom of information team, could you please tell me during Mr. Cook's time from 2016 until now 2021, how many police officers has Mr. Cook paid off, and how much money out of public funds has Chief Constable Andrew Cook paid off?" And the freedom of information request came back in the November, saying Mr. Cook had paid off in his 4 years 22 police officers, and to the tune of £351,000 worth of public money. And within weeks of that freedom of information request, if you can see the parallel system here, Mr. Cook decided to leave Merseyside Police as chief constable. And I know many retired police officers and police officers who are still there who are honest police officers who've been clapping what I'm doing, because I'm determined to, you know, get to the bottom of different things, basically. And it turns out that Mr. Cook, when he left last year, he didn't retire. He's gone now to the HMI CFRS, Her Majesty's Inspector for Constabulary and Fire Service, or something it stands for, but anybody can find out who's listening.
Well, I mean, there are all sorts of little jobs that retired chief constables can go into.
That's right.
Such as the National Policing Improvement Agency, which our own one, he went and started work there. In fact, actually, I think he came from there to become chief constable of Avon and Somerset. But anyway, look.
So the important thing there, sorry, Tony, to jump in.
Jack, we can't talk about Merseyside Police without talking about this week the murder of this young girl, Olivia.
Yeah.
And I was very surprised as a journalist to see that the police have still not issued a statement about the description for the murderer. Now, we know that various people were on the scene during the killing of this young girl. I mean, it may not be murder, it may be manslaughter, especially since he may have not realised the bullet was going to hit her. But we know that there is a description of the man, because various people saw the person. gentleman. He may have been wearing a balaclava, some people have said, but that doesn't stop you giving a description of potentially his accent if he spoke, for example, his height, his build. Even now, they believe that they have a suspect's name. They haven't given that name out. So the basics don't seem to be happening here at all. They've only just released the name of the guy who has been in hospital, who was running into the house, who this guy shot, the gunman actually shot him, or tried to shoot into the house to get him, and actually ended up killing this young girl. But the police don't seem to have done any of the journalistic basics, that is to say, getting a description out about the person that they're after, which I find unbelievable. I think the new chief constable is a woman called Serena Kennedy. She's been on the TV talking about this, but you know, none of the basic police work seems to be being done. And we also go back to the Rhys Jones case 10 years ago or so in Liverpool, where you've got somebody that, where, I mean, you may well know this yourself, Jack, that people in the area where Rhys was murdered were actually chalking up and spraying up the name of the suspect on graffiti on the wall. It's like the police just do not want to find the suspect. So what do you think is going on here, and would you compare how would you contrast what happened to you or how would what's happened to you inform what you think is going on now with Olivia's horrific murder and the national coverage that it's getting?
It's national coverage is absolutely necessary for all of us to know around the country what they're, who to know whether the police in Newcastle are just as bad as the other particular police. I mean, if I can just go back for one little moment to the North Wales police chief detective, PSD in North Wales. He is a guy called Dan Tipton, and he was well respected
so
at North.
PSD, you're talking about the Professional Standards Department.
That's right, of North Wales Police. He's retired a few months back from North Wales Police, and he's been in touch with me many times and been very helpful, and said, Mr. Jack, he said, he calls me Jack now, I've got his own mobile number. He said, when I interviewed Mr. Cook in 2017, my hands were tied because your Police and Crime Commissioner, Jane Kennedy, then changed the complaint that you put in 2014, which was a serious complaint against Mr. Cook, to a local resolution, which is a minor thing to do. He said, so I couldn't dig as deep as I could have done in what you put in that didn't get put in. So it was changed by the CEO of the Police and Crime. Police and Crime Commissioners, there are 80 of them around the country. Their duty as a Police and Crime Commissioner is to keep the police chief constables in their areas to account for the work of their police force. So presently we have on Merseyside a lady called Emily Spuddle, who is the Police and Crime Commissioner. Sadly, Emily Spuddle's office is full of ex-police people, and her office is within the police station on Merseyside, and yet she is supposed to be independent, or their office is supposed to be independent of the police. I would actually challenge, if I was, I mean, it's not my particular thing, this one that you're going on about, but if I was the people high up listening to this, I would challenge the Police and Crime Commissioner of Merseyside to find out what Serena Kennedy, as the Chief Constable, is really doing for the public. She has a duty, if she is independent, Emily Spuddle, from the Home Office to do the job as she should be doing it. Now, that's what I think is needed. Emily Spuddle must come out, not just Serena. Serena Kennedy, I haven't got many bad words, really, with her yet. All I can say about Serena Kennedy is I, on four occasions since she's been there a year now, I've invited her to meet with me to stop all of the things that's been going on for 12 years with me. Although Merseyside Police had to pay BPS Law, in 2017, Merseyside Police accepted a further claim from BPS Law of malicious prosecution by Cloherty against me, and they had to pay out BPS Law a further £90,000. And myself, they paid me off at that particular point in time, but not to keep quiet, just they paid me off to, you know. However, There's nearly £250,000 of public funds that we know about without the police's time and everything on a car door blowing in the wind. How far does public funds go with in all of this? How far do public figures like Emily Sporrells of the within the country, they must be held to account for the members of the public.
But you started off, Jack, by telling us about how, as a young person, you trusted the police, you play football in the street with a local bobby. How would you describe Merseyside police today?
What I'm going to say now, which won't take too long, but it's quite funny and is necessary to say, is Merseyside police hate me for what I'm doing now, because I'm doing it
because you've said that some of those police officers have actually been helping you.
Oh, very much so, very much. I believe, from my experience in 12 years with Merseyside police, that 60% of them are dishonest and 40% of them are honest. The honest ones, sadly, have to carry on the job and keep the heads down and not say anything, because if they might report, like Mr. Hussein did to his chief constable, and if the chief constable is not honest, then obviously a lot of people like Mr. Clohertys are not honest below them, basically. Now, when I do things to in my emails that I do to different bodies and ask them to give me answers to different questions and things, and they don't give me answers, I then write to more people within that body. Within Merseyside Police, when it was discovered that Mr. Clohertys had killed an 11-year-old girl with his driving of a police car, an unmarked police car, not many of the police officers in Merseyside Police know. Now, I made a Freedom of Information request to Merseyside Police that every policeman has their own email, and their own email is the badge number at merseysidepolice.pnn.co.uk, whatever, along those lines. Now, I asked the Freedom of Information, how many badge numbers are there in Merseyside Police? I know there's 5,000 policemen. How many badge numbers are there? And they said 10,000 badge numbers. So this actually is true. They didn't like it. The PSD were in touch with me badly. However, I sent out 10,000 emails, which I knew a lot of them would bounce back, with the evidence of Mr. Clohertys killing this girl. So I know that it went to 5,000 police officers within Merseyside Police, this particular evidence that I put out to them, saying, look, you've got Mr. Cook. This is where Mr. Cook was over a year ago. You've got Mr. Cook as your present police chief constable. And yet, look, he's covered for this man who's killed this girl, basically. And the PSD got some hundreds and hundreds of the honest officers ringing them up saying, what's going on? Is this all true? Well, obviously, it must be true if the newspapers have printed it, the six articles that I had, because they wouldn't print it because they'd be sued.
Has your case been covered very well by papers like the Liverpool Echo?
It was in 2016 when, obviously, I totally understand the newspapers that they can't just go to print on what anybody says. They must go to print with evidence, basically. And because there was evidence of the CPS charging Mr. Clohertys on three counts, then they knew they could interview me and take pictures of me and put it in the front page of the Liverpool Echo, and it go to hundreds of thousands of people on Merseyside. They knew they could do that then. Sadly, because Mr. Clohertys got off with that shadow of a doubt piece of evidence that has never been shown to us yet, today even, we actually believe, because Mr. Clohertys was one rung behind Mr. Cook, that Mr. Clohertys was looking at, in 2016, although he'd been out of the police for 3 years then, he was looking at 7 to 13 years imprisonment for the charges that he was charged with. Now, we believe that he's gone to Mr. Cook, his buddy, because he's only, you know, he's been with him 23 years in the police anyway, and said to Mr. Cook, if I go down with this, I've got a lot of evidence of other people within Merseyside. This is what we believe. We're not saying it's true. It's a summation by us. That we believe that he said, you know, if I go down, I'm going to be taking a lot of others down with me. So Mr. Cook has come up with this one piece of evidence. They dropped Mr. Hussein, a major witness. They dropped him from the list, and they produced this piece of evidence that his computer was on at 2:04. That's very, very strange, you know. But it was enough to get him off. However, what I'm aiming for at the moment, Tony, which the listeners will understand where I'm going, is that one thing I must say, in 2016, Merseyside Police PSD Department wrote me a letter of commendation saying, Mr. Beecham, we've now changed in 2016 the whole of the Merseyside Police pocket notebook policy because of you. Because you, as a member of the public, had the confidence to come to us and show us the flaws within it. That's what we've now done. So obviously that's good in some sense.
Well, I think also, you know, you may take some of the credit for the removal of this Chief Constable Cook.
Well, sadly, what I've found out from a retired policeman who's now a councillor in my area where I live, he said, Mr. Cook is the first police chief constable of Merseyside to leave Merseyside Police without getting a knighthood, which is amazing. And he said it's because of you. However, he stayed within the police system at the HMICFRS, hoping that he may get that particular knighthood. However, the Cabinet Office and the Honours Board within the Cabinet Office, who I've written to and they've wrote back to me, they've been in looking at Mr. Clougherty's situation for the last 3 years now, because he's got a Queen's Police Medal at the moment, which he can put those letters after his name. However, I don't believe anybody should have a Queen's Police Medal in the country if they are known as a dishonest person. Mr. Cook has yet to be transparent and open and honest with his situation with Mr. Clougherty. Obviously, he was the leader of Mr. Clougherty. Now, Merseyside Police, if you get in touch with them, they will tell you that Mr. Clougherty was a dishonest police officer. If he was a dishonest police officer under the leadership of Mr. Cook, how honest or dishonest is Mr. Cook? If Mr. Cook had got out because it was going to be known soon and probably put in the papers that he'd paid off £351,000 worth of public funds, how long had he got at Merseyside Police?
Anyway, so Jack, what advice have you got for people when they come across what they believe are corrupt police officers?
Basically, the only thing people can do, the first steps, if there's any police officers who they feel are corrupt, they can only go to that particular police force. The only time it goes to any other police force is if it's the Chief Constable. So most of the time, Merseyside Police, at this point in time, I have two police officers who have put in a complaint about, Sergeant Hicklin and a PC Howcroft of Merseyside Police. Merseyside Police are at this point in time refusing to investigate these two officers. The IOPC, which is run by Michael Lockwood down there in Birmingham, they're caseworkers. One is called Abigail Hart and another one, Astrid Nason, are both looking to investigate these two officers on my behalf. However, it's very, very difficult, the IOPC, which used to be the IPCC. There's a lot of ex-policemen within the ranks, and they tend to make decisions at the IOPC based on their police knowledge, and they usually get in touch, which I've found once before now, with the police force, and then make a decision afterwards without coming back to you, the complainant, in the first place, and then they make a decision against you most of the time, it seems. Anyway, my situation is that if you decide to report them to your local police force, because you must go and ask for all of the evidence, you know, the undisclosed. If anybody's been charged with anything, get as much evidence as you can and look through the evidence, because you'll find an amazing amount of stuff. I'm happy. I've given my email address out for anybody who wants to send me an email and ask me for any advice. No, not a problem. I'll give them the steps to go down totally free of charge. I'm not interested
okay,
in making.
Can you do that now, Jack?
Certainly. It's my email address is j.beecham, BEECHAM, for mother, j.beecham2@nfornormanchiefoftommylforlima, NTL World, which is all one word, ntlworld.com. And I'm happy to, based on, I mean, at the moment, there's one person in the country now, which obviously I'm not going to give out any of their data to anybody, you know, publicly like this, who I'm helping at the moment with the same police chief crime commissioner, Emily Spurrell, who's refusing to help this other person with their problem in on the Wirral.
Now, okay, so if we go back 10 years or so, to the time of the Rhys Jones murder, and even then there were disclosures coming out on the BBC, from the BBC and others, saying eight Merseyside police gun crime officers were suspended because they were taking items seized during police raids and then just flogging them for their own raising money on eBay. Are Merseyside police in any way effective against the power of, you know, the drug barons, prostitution, organised crime generally?
Who knows is the answer to that question, Tony. It's unfortunately, even Serena Kennedy, not this week, but a few months back when she became the new police chief constable, and they had to dismiss a detective within Merseyside Police for his corruption. She came out on television and she said she knows she's running the police force that is not 100% honest. She knows that, but she's doing her best to try and wheedle out any that she comes across. However, getting to hold of Serena Kennedy to sit down with you, which I've asked four times to sit down with me, I get no response whatsoever from Serena Kennedy.
Well done for doing it, Jack. And it might even be she might think of recruiting you as one of her top detectives, because you seem to have done an amazing detective work yourself. If you could just wind up, Jack, by just repeating your email if people want to get hold of you, please.
Yep, I'll just say it in one go now. It's j.beacham2@ntlworld.com.
Okay, Jack Beacham, thanks very much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks, Tony.